Parabola, the magazine of myth and tradition in association with Mystic Fire Video, present Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. Program 3, The First Storytellers.
The animal envoys of the unseen power no longer serve, as in primeval times, to teach and to guide mankind. Bears, lions, elephants, and gazelles are in cages in our zoos. Man is no longer the newcomer in a world of unexplored plains and forests. And our immediate neighbors are not wild beasts, but other human beings contending for goods and space on a planet that is whirling without end around the fireball of a star. Neither in body nor in mind do we inhabit the world of those hunting races of the Paleolithic millennia, to whose lives and life ways we nevertheless owe the very forms of our bodies and structures of our minds. Memories of their animal envoys still must sleep somehow within us, for they wake a little and stir when we venture into wilderness. They wake in terror to thunder. And again they wake with a sense of recognition when we enter any one of those great painted caves. Whatever the inward darkness may have been to which the shamans of those caves descended in their trances, the same must lie within ourselves, nightly visited in sleep.
Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. The First Storytellers.
When we look at the magnificent cave paintings left by our primal ancestors, we realize how the hunters of those early tribes were influenced by their natural surroundings and by their feelings toward the animals they depended on for food, religious feelings. They told stories to themselves about the animals and about the supernatural world to which the animals seemed to go when they died. And the hunters performed rituals of atonement to the departed spirits of the animals, hoping to coax them back to be sacrificed again. Joseph Campbell devoted his life to the study of these myths and rituals. For him, mythic stories were not simply entertaining tales to be told for amusement around ancient campfires. They were powerful guides to the life of the spirit. Campbell's odyssey as scholar and teacher led him from the exhibits at the American Museum of Natural History, which impressed him as a boy, to cultures all over the world. In his words, "Whether we listen with aloof amusement to the mumbo-jumbo of some witch doctor of the Congo, or read with cultivated rapture translations from sonnets of Lao Tse, or now and again crack the hard nutshell of an argument of Thomas Aquinas, or catch suddenly the shining meaning of a bizarre Eskimo fairy tale, we're hearing echoes of the first story." In this hour, one of the many I taped with Joseph Campbell during the last 2 years of his life, we talked about our relationship to the first stories and to the people who told them. Like them, we too perform rituals to enact what we believe about the world beyond this one. And we try to bring our mind into harmony with questions of immortality and our body with its destiny of death. What do you think our souls owe to ancient myths?
Well, the ancient myths were designed to put the mind, the mental system, into accord with this body system, with this inheritance.
A harmony?
Of the body, to harmonize. The mind can ramble off in strange ways and want things that the body does not want. And the myths and rites were means to put the mind in accord with the body and the way of life in accord with the way that nature dictates.
So in a way, these old stories live in us.
They do indeed. And the stages of a human development are the same today as they were in the ancient times. And the problem of a child brought up in a world of discipline, of obedience, and of his dependency on others has to be transcended when one comes to maturity, so that you are living now not in dependency, but with self-responsible authority. And the problem of the transition from childhood to maturity, and then from maturity and full capacity to losing those powers and acquiescing in the natural course of, you might say, the autumn time of life and the passage away. Myths are there to help us go with it, accept nature's way and not hold to something else.
The stories are sort of, to me, like messages in a bottle from shores someone else has visited first.
Yes, and you're visiting those shores now.
And these myths tell me how others have made the passage and how I can make the passage.
And also what the beauties are of the way. I feel this now, moving into my own last years, you know. The myths help me to go with it.
What kind of myth? Give me a one that has actually helped you.
Well, the tradition in India, for instance, of actually changing your whole way of dress, even changing your name as you pass from one stage to another. When I retired from teaching, I knew that I had to create a new life, a new way of life, and I changed my manner of thinking about my life, just in terms of that notion of moving out of the sphere of achievement into the sphere of enjoyment and appreciation and relaxing into the wonder of it all.
And then there is that final passage through the dark gate.
That's no problem at all. The problem in middle life, when the body has reached its climax of power and begins to lose it, is to identify yourself not with the body, which is falling away, but with the consciousness of which it is a vehicle. And when you can do that, and this is something I learned from my myths, what am I? Am I the bulb that carries the light, or am I the light of which the bulb is a vehicle? And this body is a vehicle of consciousness. And if you can identify with the consciousness, you can watch this thing go like an old car. There goes the fender, there goes this. But that's expectable, you know? And then gradually, the whole thing drops off and consciousness rejoins consciousness. I mean, it's no longer in this particular environment.
And the myths, the stories have brought this consciousness.
Well, I live with these myths and they tell me to do this all the time. And this is the problem, which can be then metaphorically understood as identifying with the Christ in you. And the Christ in you doesn't die. The Christ in you survives death and resurrects. Or it can be with Shiva. Shiva hung, I am Shiva. And this is the great meditation of the yogis in the Himalayas. And one doesn't have even to have a metaphorical image like that if one has a mind that's willing to just relax and identify itself with that which moves it.
You say that the image of death is the beginning of mythology. What do you mean? How is that?
Well, all I can say to that is that the earliest evidence we have of anything like mythological thinking is associated with grave burials.
And they suggest what? That men, women saw life and then they didn't see it and they wondered about it?
It must have been. I mean, one has only to, you know, imagine what one's own experience would be. The person was alive and warm before you and talking to you. He's now lying there, getting cold, beginning to rot. Something was there that isn't there, and where is it? Now, animals have this experience, certainly, of their companions dying and so forth,
but there's no evidence that they've had any further thoughts about it. Mm-hmm. Also, before the time of Neanderthal man, it's in his period that the first burials appear, that of which we have evidence, people were dying and they're just thrown away. But here there's a concern.
Have you ever visited any of these burial sites?
I've been to Le Moustier. That was one of the earliest burial caves that were found.
And you find there what they buried with the dead?
Yes. These grave burials with grave gear, that is to say, weapons and sacrifices round about, certainly suggest the idea of the continued life beyond the visible one. First one that was discovered, person is put down, resting as though asleep, a young boy, with a beautiful hand axe beside him. Now, at the same time, we have evidence of shrines devoted to animals that have been killed. The shrines specifically are in the Alps, in very high caves, and they are of cave bear skulls. And there is one very interesting one with the long bones of the cave bear in the cave bear's jaw.
What does that say to you?
Burials. My friend has died and he survives. The animals that I've killed must also survive. I must make some kind of atonement relationship to them. The indication is of the notion of a plane of being that's behind the visible plane, and which is somehow supportive of the visible one to which we have to relate. I would say that's the basic theme of all mythology.
That there is a world?
That there is a visible an invisible plane supporting the visible one. Now, whether it is thought of as a world or simply as an energy, that differs from time and time and place to place.
What we don't know supports what we do know.
That's right. The basic hunting myth, I would say, is of a kind of covenant between the animal world and the human world, where the animal gives its life willingly. They are regarded generally as willing victims, with the understanding that their life, which transcends their physical entity, will be returned to the soil or to the mother through some ritual of restoration. And the principal rituals, for instance, and the principal divinities are associated with the main hunting animal, the animal who is the master animal and sends the flocks to be killed, you know? The Indians of the American plains, it was the buffalo. You go to the northwest coast, it's the salmon. The great festivals have to do with the run of salmon coming in. When you go to South Africa, the eland, the big, magnificent antelope, is the principal animal, for the bushman, for example.
And the principal animal, the
is the
master
one that
animal,
furnishes the food.
The food. So there grew up between human beings and animals a bonding, as you say, which required one to be consumed by the other.
That's the way life is.
Do you think this troubled the early man? That
absolutely.
He felt some,
that's why you have the rites, because it did trouble him.
What kind of rites?
Rituals of appeasement to the animals, of thanks to the animal. Very interesting aspect here is the identity of the hunter with the animal.
You mean after the animal has
been
shot?
After the animal has been killed. The hunter then has to fulfill certain rites in a kind of participation mystique, a mystic participation with the animals whose death he has brought about and whose meat is to become his life. So the killing is not simply slaughter. At any rate, it's a ritual act. It's a recognition of your dependency and of the voluntary giving of this food to you by the animal who has given it. It's a beautiful thing. It turns life into a mythological experience.
The hunt becomes what?
It becomes a ritual. Mm-hmm. The hunt is a ritual.
Expressing a hope of resurrection, that the animal was food and you needed the animal to return.
And some kind of respect for the animal that was killed. Yep. That's the thing that gets me all the time in this hunting ceremonial system.
Respect for the animal.
Respect for the animal, and more than respect. I mean, that animal becomes a messenger of divine power, you see.
And you wind up as the hunter killing the messenger.
Killing the god.
What does this do? Does it cause guilt? Does it cause...
No, guilt is what is wiped out by the myth. It is not a personal act. You are performing the work of nature. For example, in Japan, in Hokkaido, northern Japan, among the Ainu people, whose principal mountain deity is the bear. When it is killed, there is a ceremony of feeding the bear a feast of its own flesh, as though he were present, and he is present. He served his own meat for dinner, and there's a conversation between the mountain god, the bear, and the people. They say, if you will give us the privilege of entertaining you again, we'll give you the privilege of another bear sacrifice.
If the cave bear were not appeased, the animals wouldn't appear, and these primitive hunters would starve to death. So they began to perceive some kind of power on which they were dependent, greater than their own.
And that's the power of the animal master. Now, when we sit down to meal, we thank God, you know, our idea of God for having given us this. These people thank the animal.
And is this the first evidence we have of an act of worship?
Yes.
Of power superior to man?
Yeah.
And the animal was superior because the animal provided food?
Well, now, in contrast to our relationship to animals, where we see animals as a lower form of life, and in the Bible we're told, you know, we're the masters and so forth, early hunting people don't have that relationship to the animal. The animal is in many ways superior. He has powers that the human being doesn't have.
And then certain animals take on a persona, don't they? The buffalo, the raven, the eagle.
Very strongly. Well, I was up in the northwest coast back in 1932. It was a wonderful trip. And the Indians along the way were still carving totem poles. The villagers had new totem poles still. And there we saw the ravens, and we saw the eagles, and we saw the animals that played roles in the myths. And they had the character, the quality of these animals. There's a very intimate knowledge and friendly, neighborly relationship to these creatures. And then they killed some of them, you see. The animal had something to do with the shaping of the myths of those people, just as the buffalo for the Indians of the plains played an enormous role. They're the ones that bring the tobacco of gift, the mystical pipe and all this kind of thing. It comes from a buffalo. And when the animal becomes the giver of a ritual and so forth, they do ask the animal for advice, and the animal becomes the model for how to live.
You remember the story of the buffalo's wife?
That's a basic legend of the Blackfoot tribe, and is the origin legend of their buffalo dance rituals,
which they
invoke the cooperation of the animals in this play of life. When you realize the size of some of these tribal groups, to feed them required a good deal of meat. And one way of acquiring meat for the winter would be to drive a buffalo herd to stampede it over a rock cliff. Well, this story is of a Blackfoot tribe long, long ago. And they couldn't get the buffalo to go over the cliff. The buffalo would approach the cliff and then turn aside. So it looked as though they weren't going to have any meat for that winter. Well, the daughter of one of the houses, getting up early in the morning to draw the water for the family and so forth, looks up, and there, right above the cliff, were the buffalo. And she said, oh, if you'd only come over, I'd marry one of you. And to her surprise, they all began coming over. That was surprise number one. Surprise number two was when one of the old buffaloes, the shaman of the herd, comes and says, all right, girlie, off we go. Oh, no, she says. Oh, yes, he said, you made your promise. We've kept our side of the bargain. Look at all my relatives here dead. Off we go. Well, the family gets up in the morning and they look around and where's Minnehaha, you know? But the father, you know how Indians are, he looked around, he said, she's run off with a buffalo. He could see by the footsteps. So he says, I'm going to get her back. So he puts on his walking moccasins, bow and arrow and so forth, and goes out over the plains. He's gone quite a distance when he feels he better sit down and rest. And he comes to a place that's called a buffalo wallow, where the buffalo like to come and roll around and get the lice off and roll around in the mud. So he sits down there and is thinking what he should do now, when along comes a magpie. Now, it's a beautiful, flashing bird. And it's one of those clever birds that has shamanic qualities.
Magical qualities.
Magical. And the man says to him, oh, beautiful bird, he said, my daughter ran away with a buffalo. Have you seen, would you hunt around and see if you can find her out on the plain somewhere? And the magpie says, well, there's a lovely girl with the buffaloes right now over there, just a bit away. Well, he said, the man, would you go tell her that her daddy's here, her father's here at the buffalo wallow? Magpie flies over, and the girl is there among the buffalo. They're all asleep. I don't know what she's doing, knitting or something of the kind. And the magpie comes over close to her and he says, your father's over at the wallow waiting for you. Oh, she said, this is terrible. This is dangerous. I mean, these buffalo, they'll kill us. You tell him to wait. I'll be over. I'll try to work this out. So her buffalo husband's behind her and he wakes up and takes off a horn. He says, go to the wallow and get me a drink. So she takes the horn and goes over, and there's her father. He grabs her by the arm. He says, come. She says, no, 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 this is real dangerous. The whole herd, they'll be right after us. I have to work this thing out. Now, let me just go back. So she gets the water and goes back, and he, fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Indian, you know, that sort of thing. And she says, no, nothing of the kind. He says, yes, indeed. So he gives a buffalo bellow, and they all get up, and they all do a slow buffalo dance with their tails raised, and they go over, and they trample that poor man to death so that he disappears entirely. He's just all broken up to pieces and all gone. So the girl's crying, and her buffalo husband says, so you're crying? Yes, this is my daddy. He said, yeah, but what about us? There are our children, our wives, our parents, and you crying about your daddy. Well, apparently he was a kind of sympathetic, compassionate buffalo, and he said, well, I'll tell you, if you can bring your daddy back to life again, I'll let you go. So she turns to the magpie and says, see, peck around a little bit and see if you can find a bit of daddy. And the magpie does so, and he comes up finally with a vertebra, just one little bone. And the little girl says, that's plenty. Now, we put this down on the ground, and she puts her blanket over it, and she sings a revivifying song, a magical song with great power. And presently, yes, there's a man under the blanket. She looks, daddy all right, but he's not breathing yet. A few more stanzas of whatever the song was, and he stands up, and the buffalo are amazed. And they say, well, why don't you do this for us? We'll teach you now our buffalo dance, and when you will have killed our families, you do this dance and sing this song, and we'll all be back alive again. That's the basic idea, that through the ritual, that dimension is struck which transcends temporality and out of which life comes and back into which it goes.
And it goes back to this whole idea of death, burial, and resurrection, not only for human beings,
but for the animals too.
So the story of the buffalo's wife was told to confirm the reverence.
That's right.
What happened when the white man came and slaughtered this animal of reverence?
That was a sacramental violation. I mean, in the 80s, when the buffalo hunt was undertaken, you know,
the 1880s,
Kit Carson,
years
Buffalo
ago.
Bill, yeah. And so forth. When I was a boy, whenever we went for sleigh rides, we had a buffalo robe. Buffalo, buffalo, buffalo robes all over the place. This was the sacred animal of the Indian. These hunters go out with repeating rifles and shoot down the whole herd and leave it there. They take the skin to sell and the bodies left to rot. This is a sacrilege. And it really is a sacrilege.
It turned the buffalo from a thou
to an it.
The Indians addressed the buffalo as a thou, an object of reverence.
The Indians addressed life as a thou. I mean, trees, and stones, and everything else. You can address anything as a thou, and you can feel the change in your psychology as you do it. The ego that sees a thou is not the same ego that sees an it. Your whole psychology changes when you address things as an it.
Whether it's a woman.
And when you go to war with the people, the problem of the newspapers is to turn those people into its so that they're not thous.
That was an incredible moment in the evolution of American society when the buffalo was slaughtered. That was the final exclamation point behind the destruction of the Indian civilization, because you were destroying...
Can you imagine what this experience must have been for a people within 10 years to lose their environment, to lose their food supply, to lose the central object of their ritual life?